Just as the seasons are strangely out of tune, the Australian people are adjusting to a new federal government led by the unlikely Prime Minister Kevin Rudd. In November, Rudd replaced the unlikely John Howard, who just happened to be Australia's second longest serving Prime Minister, from 1996 to November 2007. Both Howard and Rudd are similar kind of men. Both are curmudgeonly, avaricious nerds. Howard was a bespectacled, grasping lawyer from Earlwood in inner Sydney. Rudd was an overly ambitious, bowl-haircutted, Mandarin-speaking diplomat bureaucrat from Queensland. In many ways, the rise and longevity of Howard and the rise of Rudd speaks volumes for the current political process. No flash Harrys wanted, like former Prime Ministers Hawke and Keating, or the former crazy, brave opposition leader Mark Latham. Ordinary competence seems to be what Australians want in their leaders in these times. Meanwhile, Australia's institutions and our press are so well tuned to the dominant two-party system that no one is prepared to think beyond what emerges from the political sausage factory. Let's hope the rain symbolises something, and that the new man Rudd will do more than just set up committees and fall back on party rhetoric.
Down the
Brothers, Capricorn Rain from their album Under the Mango Tree. The whole country breathed a sigh of relief when Prime Minister Kevin Rudd used his first parliamentary session on February 13 to say, thankfully, sorry to the Indigenous people who were separated from their families by successive government interventions over the course of the 20th century. These people have come to be called the Stolen Generations. Many Australians fought in World War II against governments and countries that wanted to found societies on the basis of race. Yet in Australia, from the late 19th century to the late 20th century, eugenic principles have been behind the policies of taking Aboriginal children from their families, breeding out the Aboriginality from their physical appearance, culture and psychology. These policies were not carried out by evil Nazis, they were carried out by ordinary Australian bureaucrats, policemen, welfare officers and other seemingly benevolent individuals. Many Australians, former Prime Minister John Howard chief amongst them, will not acknowledge the sorry modern Australian history of Aboriginal people. The Murdoch press is the chief cheerleader of what has been dubbed the culture wars. The fight is between conservatives like Howard, who argue there is nothing to say sorry for and are proud of the benevolent egalitarian pioneers who through hard work and grit made the country great, and the so-called black armbanders who see Australia as second only to South Africa's apartheid regime in terms of its racial discrimination against not only Indigenous people but non-Europeans in general. It needs to be noted here that two-thirds of Aboriginal Australians live in remote and regional places, while two-thirds of mainstream Australia live in the major cities. Most mainstream Australians never directly encounter or befriend one of the half a million Aboriginal people, nor have they heard firsthand about their experiences. This results in a tremendous amount of hearsay, ignorance and speculation. The Australian newspaper, for example, on Tuesday, July 10, 2007, published a typical front-page Aboriginal story. It was headed, Pilbara Men on Sex Charges. But in fact, the story was about the Kimberley town of Halls Creek, situated 1.5 thousand kilometres to the north. What was remarkable to me was that no one even noted the mistake. So the Pilbara community were maligned, and nobody cared or even knew enough to acknowledge the mistake. In its editorial of 28 March 2008, Murdoch's Australian argued that Australia's century of racial engineering belonged alongside pioneering US family planning techniques advocated by Margaret Sanger, who innocently, it seemed, linked birth control, racial betterment, and elimination of the unfit, which should not be seen alongside the murderous atrocities of the 20th century. For the Australian, not directly committing murder is a let-out clause. Australia's racial administrators were well-intentioned but misinformed. It was not a century of racial engineering, exclusion and discrimination that led to the appalling health, education and economic plight of Australia's Aboriginal people. No, the Australian wants to maintain that came as a result of being given citizenship rights in 1967. This is typical of the intellectual complacency of conservative intellectual elites and their followers, most of whom have never had an Aboriginal friend nor any first-hand comprehension of the generational damage caused by Australia's secret eugenic war against Aboriginal people that lasted 100 years. This regime effectively murdered individuals and communities, whether benevolently or malevolently.
This is a story of colonization. It's a story that's been told before. It's the blood of indigenous races on the hands of invading force. There's a government and an army not far from these north shores, and the tribesmen in the jungle, they fight a secret war.
heart of the old PN now? What's in the heart of a me and you? Cause it's run in the heart of people for freedom, same as it flowed in the Kalkadoo.
It was the Warumpi Band, Secret War, from their album Go Bush, that was produced by Festival Records back in 1987. In 1992, Kevin Rudd's Labour Prime Ministerial predecessor, Paul Keating, spoke on behalf of all European Australians in his historic Redfern speech. He said, "It begins, I think, with the act of recognition. Recognition that it was we who did the dispossessing. We took the traditional lands and smashed the traditional way of life. We brought the diseases, the alcohol. We committed the murders. We took the children from their mothers. We practiced discrimination and exclusion. It was our ignorance and our prejudice and our failure to imagine these things being done to us. With some noble exceptions, we failed to make the most basic human response and enter into their hearts and minds. We failed to ask, how would I feel if this were done to me? As a consequence, we failed to see that what we were doing degraded us all." By apologising to the stolen generations, Rudd carried on this recognition and education of Australians about their history. Because of Australia's cultural and intellectual slothfulness, the stolen generation underwent a long persecution, but they never gave up on reconnecting with their families and communities, and the apology of Prime Minister Rudd brought them finally a symbolic victory. Sorry meant that at least one part of Australia's secret war was over. However, the stolen generations are a modern Australian responsibility. Many, including the editorial writers of the Australian newspaper, simply do not understand that Australia's eugenic experiment is at the root of many of the problems that currently befall Aboriginal communities. Every one of Australia's thousand-strong Aboriginal language groups had different experiences, but we can generalise for the purposes of exposition. Arguably, the most terrible period for Indigenous Australians was between first European contact in 1770 and 1861, when the Aboriginal population fell from as many as 1 or 2 million to 181,000. But after the onslaught of disease, direct military invasions and vigilante assaults, from 1861 onwards, a more insidious secret war began against Aboriginal people. With the publication of Charles Darwin's Origins of the Species in 1859, Aboriginal people began to be perceived as a disappearing species or race, destined to be overtaken by the superior white species. The concept of racial feebleness effectively prohibited recognition of Aboriginal people as citizens with full rights to participate in Australian society or to be recognised by Australia's first national constitution of 1901. They were, as many Aboriginal people now joke, deemed part of Australia's flora and fauna. Even before the taking away of children from their families, the Australian state planned protectorates, where Aboriginal culture and communities could gradually dwindle away and die. In the best circumstances, traditional Aboriginal hunting areas were preserved as reserved, but in the worst, and the majority of cases, Aboriginal people were confined to reserves without any rights to work or lead an independent life on their own lands or in the larger community. Dog tags were given to select numbers of Indigenous people, providing them with limited mainstream citizenship rights, such as being able to work in the mainstream community. Government protectorates were the deep origin of the Australia's remote and regional Aboriginal welfare ghettos. It was not Aboriginal people who created the reserves with no rights and conditions of utter dependency. It was successive Australian governments and administrations. Yes, it is true, as John Howard in the Australian newspaper continually chimed, that there were exceptional situations where black, just like white children, were taken away from harmful situations for their own good. Yes, it's true that some missionaries, particularly Lutherans, accepted Aboriginal people as equal before God. But the dominant eugenic tone of Australia was to discriminate, repress and belittle Aboriginal people. From 1860 onwards, Aboriginal protection leagues were imbued with an eugenic principle, and government departmental heads were often made the legal guardians of all Aboriginal children. The goals of government were to simultaneously protect the dying race and to separate those out of mixed race who could be assimilated into the European society. In the 1930s, the eugenic power of the state was intensified, and Aboriginal administrators like the infamous Western Australian protector of Aborigines, J.W. Neville, who was portrayed in the film Rabbit Proof Fence, were given the power to determine every aspect of the lives of Aboriginal people. Beneath the struggle of Aboriginal activists for citizenship rights in the 20th century, Aboriginal families were being torn apart by the policies of protection, assimilation and paternalism. Tens of thousands of Aboriginal children were separated from their families and placed in orphanages or adopted out into white family homes. This was all partly revealed by the Bringing Them Home inquiry headed by Sir Ronald Wilson and Professor Mick Dodson. The tragedy was that the report was first released in 1996 when the Howard government first came to office, and it was met with the same complacency and intellectual slothfulness displayed by today's Australian newspaper. 12 years later, on February 13, 2008, the new Prime Minister Rudd did what Wilson and Dodson had called for. He apologised on behalf of Australia's national government to those who were wrongfully taken away from the families. But an apology isn't enough. Australian federal and state governments must now compensate the stolen generation and their families by monetary and cultural means. The Bringing Them Home report recommended that monetary compensation be provided to people affected by forcible removal under the following heads: racial discrimination, arbitrary deprivation of liberty, pain and suffering, abuse including physical, sexual and emotional abuse, disruption of family life, loss of cultural rights and fulfillment, loss of native title rights, labour exploitation, economic loss and loss of opportunity. Currently, the stolen generation must fight for compensation individually through lengthy and expensive court cases. Bruce Trevorrow was awarded $525,000 in damages by the Supreme Court of South Australia in August 2007 after a 10-year legal battle. Trevorrow, now 50, was just 13 months old when he was taken to hospital on Christmas Day in 1957. He made a good recovery but was subsequently given to a white foster family with whom he remained for 10 years. When his mother inquired as to her son's whereabouts, the Aboriginal Protection Board lied to her, saying he was still sick and the doctors needed to give him treatment. Many stolen generation claimants have died without ever hearing an apology or getting justice. But if the Trevorrow case is a guide, the Australian people will have a multi-billion dollar bill to pay. This is where the Rudd government have been bitterly disappointing. If it had any leadership qualities, administrative sense or compassion, it would establish one fund contributed to by the Commonwealth and state governments to provide compensation to the stolen generation and eliminate all lawyers from the process. In doing so, Rudd could consult Aboriginal leaders who have a wealth of ideas about how funding can be provided on behalf of the stolen generation to revive and develop Aboriginal communities. Imagine a stolen generation fund that honoured the spirit and tenacity of the stolen generation, provided support for their reconnection with families and communities, and which invested in the development of, for example, Aboriginal education and health. It's all too much to hope for, however. The belated apology was as far as Rudd and his minders were prepared to go on February 13. because he was not prepared to buck the intellectual laziness and inept quality of Australian news editorials, Rudd would not go any further. Polls showed the great majority of Australians do not favour monetary compensation for the stolen generation. But what does Rudd's lack of political leadership really mean? Courts, lawyers and mindless bureaucracy will dominate. Potentially billions of dollars will be wasted. And once again, dollars will not fall into the hands of those who should be compensated, nor will it be invested in meaningful and positive developments for Aboriginal people. It's a relief to get rid of John Howard, the prototype white suburban ignoramus on Aboriginal affairs. But anyone who thinks that the Rudd government has any answers for Aboriginal people needs to get black to reality. Here's the formidable singer-songwriter Rochelle Pitt Watson from the Butchala Biri Gubba people.
Black, black.